down the ground.
We're
receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 191.PR2321, certificate number 13321, cask 263.
Yeah, that sounds kind of like the title of like a song on a Def Leppard record.
Yeah, I was
cask
trying to
263.
Think. It's definitely a big step up from Vortex 1.
Yeah.
Cask 263. Couldn't it be more. One of those early 2000s bands?
It could, right? Or like an early...
I love Cask 263.
Early 70s sort of jazz rock record.
Did I say it right? Is it 263 or is it 263?
I would say Cask 263.
Who died and made you Cask librarian?
You know what? We're going to get some responses to this episode because although you and I, neither of us are, we don't drink alcohol.
We don't.
For various reasons. You have never had alcohol. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm sure it's.
I mean, not in a cake.
And, you know, yeah, I've had alcohol in food. I'm sure I've sipped a drink only to discover then that it wasn't virgin and sent it back.
I, on the other hand, drank all of the alcohol of a lifetime, of a normal human lifetime.
And mine.
And your lifetime, but I just concentrated it into a much shorter period. So I have had all of the booze. It's just, I've just compressed it into a period between the ages of 15 and 26.
Thank you for taking my, thank you for doing my drinking for me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Like the little kid that gets spanked for the crown prince or the dauphin.
Yeah, exactly. When people say, Ken, you know, like, how dare you not lift your share?
Oh, I was sowing my wild oats. I was just doing it as John Roderick.
Actual oats. You were actually...
I was having steel cut oatmeal.
Yeah, sowing wild oats.
Did you not know that Latter-day Saints actually appoint a person to do all their drinking and partying for them? Like a Shabbos goy?
No, really?
No, that is not true.
You really had me going. Every religion's got its own little thing. I thought maybe you had, you got a couple of like Italians.
We have to do our patriotic duty for the beer and liquor industries. Every drop we don't drink, somebody has to take care of.
Well, the beer and liquor industries are, as you know, billion-dollar industries both.
Big, what do we call them? Big booze.
Big booze. But kind of unlike the beer industry, which has expanded in both breadth and depth, but it's, you know, it's harder to charge a pretty penny for a beer past a certain point, right? Because it's a beer. It's not like...
What's the most you can get hipsters to pay for some...
What's the most...
Hoppy, raspberry-ish...
beer? It's got to be some sort of Belgian beer.
With notes of sumac and Thai basil.
Oh, you think you're being ridiculous, but we're going to get into that.
I think I'm being ridiculous, but actually that's what Will Wheaton is drinking right now.
Yeah, something that that smells like...
It has sumac and Thai basil.
Sumac. The world's most expensive beer, apparently, is
Miller
something...
Miller Lite?
No.
Yeah, oh, no, Miller High Life, right.
It's Miller High Life, but from the 60s. It tastes exactly like a skunk. Let's see here. Brewdog The End of History, which is a Belgian blonde ale that apparently is served inside of a dead squirrel.
I don't know if I'd pay extra for that.
Oh, I'm not kidding. The bottles are inside taxidermied squirrels.
It's a biodegradable festival of life.
So it looks like a squirrel, but with a beer bottle coming out of its... It looks like you forced a beer bottle into a squirrel. It's really grotesque.
Do you take off that? Is it a screw top where you take off the head?
No. It's the squirrel's head. Eyes and ears and everything. It's all there.
Are you drinking from the head or the tail?
You're drinking from the mouth of the squirrel.
I think that's correct. That seems
you don't want to drink out of its butt.
No, that's good etiquette.
Those dead squirrel bottles, these are really terrible. Trigger alert, if you're not into what this sounds like, you're really not going to be into what it looks like.
I have a kid who will not look at taxidermy, which means you can't go to any natural history museum dedicated before 1960. And we just went to some restaurant on Capitol Hill the other night, and only to find out that the whole thing had a hunting lodge theme.
Yeah.
And we had to see my kid facing the corner.
Had to run out screaming. Well, those are $765 per bottle. As we'll see, the bottle sometimes makes a difference in the price. Wait, the Lost Abbey Cable Car Creek is $900 a bottle. Wait, this is one of those.
I don't like paying by the word. I don't need a beer with a 6-word name.
No, agreed.
If it has like a Doctor Who joke in it or whatever, however they name IPAs today.
There are expensive beers, but in the range of a couple hundred bucks.
And even these are comical outliers, like the burger on the menu that has gold leaf.
Yeah. And actually, gold leaf will play into part of our story in a minute here, too. There is a... I guess the reason that Lost Abbey Cable Car Creek sells for close to $1,000 a bottle is that it's no longer made.
Ah.
And so there were only a few places.
That's the same reason I'll pay $1,000 for a can of apple slice from 1989.
That's no longer made.
You can't get it anywhere.
The a transformation happened fairly recently where certain of these luxury comestibles became investments in addition to their status as just something for rich people to burn money on.
Usually this creates problems when that happens, right?
Yeah.
Because suddenly the people who actually would like to consume it for its normal purpose have to compete with the investor class. And in some cases, that just means you can't afford an apartment in Vancouver anymore.
Yeah. Well, and so there are the people that want to use the thing, mm-hmm. right? And then there's the
speculators.
There's the investor class, but then there's also the collector class, which wants to own it, but isn't really buying it as a speculator or to get rich, and they aren't necessarily buying it to use it. They just want to have it.
This happened in antique maps. It used to be you'd actually have to be some kind of scholar or weirdo or both to be interested in bidding on old maps whenever they would appear.
I feel like I'm both.
And now, absolutely. I'm 100% both.
I have a collection of old maps. Do you have old maps?
I have some old maps.
Yeah.
I enjoy them more than I collect them. But now you're competing with literal multimillionaires who decided, at some point people were like, this looks great over the couch. And then suddenly there was a mass audience to contend with. And then people were like, these are undervalued. This is the next big thing. And then the money poured in.
Yeah.
And you can't actually get one because you love it, because you're competing with people who are like, this 17th century Portuguese map might double in value next year.
Right. All those Viennese like rare booksellers started tearing apart their old atlases and for the color plate maps.
People would actually steal them from libraries because, right. There'd be super valuable maps in these kind of unguarded books. So you just cough and then drag an X-Acto knife along a book.
Oh,
terrible. And librarians wouldn't know for years what had gone missing.
Because nobody wanted to look at that old book.
Yeah, how often do people look at the average book in a library?
Oh, that's awful. So anyway, we're going to get a lot of response to this show because I know there are a lot of futurelings who are in the consuming class of spirits and beers and cigars. Because
and they'll drag themselves out of a pool of their own vomit in their depraved lifestyle to send off an angry missive.
Well, it's a style actually of bar now, the rare whiskey bar. Yeah. And you see them in Seattle, you see them everywhere you go, where the whole point of the bar is that they have 500 rare whiskeys, 500 bourbons, and you can go, and some of them, you know, the ones up literally on the top shelf are hundreds of dollars for a shot of this whiskey. And it's a kind of it's a way people use to express connoisseurship, because
and you want to be seen doing it, right? You could also buy that at auction, drink it at home with a jazz record playing,
right?
But you want to be seen as a person of status and taste.
I mean, it's the thing about being a connoisseur, right? It's a social experience for a lot of people. I mean, I'm sure there are people who have extremely expensive tastes who really sit at home and out of a brandy snifter identify all the overtones of shoe leather or whatever in their thing.
But to hold at bay the actual kind of hollowness and meaninglessness of any of this kind of pursuit, you have to have other people to distract you.
And so there are so many people in this world. Let's just start there. There's so many people in the world, Ken. Over 6 billion.
More than you think.
And a surprising number of them, even though it's a very tiny fraction of the people in the world, a surprisingly large number of them are filthy rich.
Yeah.
And so you have an image of like the son of a Russian oligarch or a Chinese billionaire, a callow Chinese billionaire who can they can drink a $10,000 bottle of wine, and it is a showy and kind of vulgar expression of wealth, because it's such a, you know, such a fleeting experience. You drink a glass of wine and then it's gone forever. How long did it last? Right? I mean, you're probably not doing it for the buzz.
I often think about also the quality multiplier. Like, if that bottle of wine costs 200 times what a pretty nice bottle of wine costs, is it 200 times better?
Right.
Or is it 1.5 times better? You know, I have a hard time with luxury goods for that reason.
Yeah.
I'll be like, do I really want the seat on the plane that costs three times as much, but is actually just only slightly better because both seats are going to Dallas?
Yeah. In that case, you seem to have decided you do want that better seat, or at least.
I have a lot more upgrade miles right now than I used to.
You sure like to send me photographs of yourself sitting in those big, wide seats. But yeah,
but do you ever have a problem with that? You're like, why does this thing cost 80 times? And I guess that's part of the appeal for people. It's better because it costs 80 times as much.
Well, you and I talk about this a lot, right? Because I will make some mocking reference to your Mickey Mouse watch, and you'll get a little bit of a stern look on your face, and you'll go, it's actually a nice watch.
It's not a nice watch.
It's a Seiko, right?
It's a Seiko from the 80s they don't make anymore.
Right. I absolutely think that, I mean, I sometimes look at pictures of a beautiful Rolex watch, an old one, and I love everything about it. I love the connection to the 1960s and 70s. I love the idea of a handmade Swiss machine. They're beautiful. Mm-hmm. They convey a kind of thing. I mean, a new Rolex conveys a different kind of thing. But yeah, taste and old school elegance. But there is no part of me that needs to tell the time. A, full stop. I do not need to know the time almost under any condition, except on Wednesdays when we record the show and you're like,
I'm already at your house.
Yeah, where are you? And I'm like, oh, is it that time already?
I forgot my laptop.
But like, you know, the cheapest Rolex you could find is probably $7,000, which is more than I've ever paid for anything. So I keep hoping that I'm going to inherit someone's Rolex, but I've looked at all the men and women in my family, and although there are a couple of cousins that own Rolexes, I'm not in the line of succession to receive them, right? Like every cousin would have to die.
13 people would have to do some King Ralph style lightning strike, exactly. And you get a Rolex.
All of a sudden, you know, I get a lady's Rolex, and I would wear the shit out of it. But So yeah, I mean, I love some notions of it. That in particular, the watch thing. But I'll almost never. I don't know how rich I would have to be to believe that a $10,000 watch was. I guess it's a form of men's jewelry. It's one of the few things that a man can adorn himself with.
On, yeah.
And, you know, and a woman can have a $50,000 necklace or earrings, I guess, if you're living in, or $500,000 jewelry. And this is the one thing a man can wear that says, like, I'm a flashy guy. But I don't, that's not me, right? I'll never, I would buy.
You ever put anything in a hotel safe?
No.
Yeah.
No, what? I look at them.
They're fun to play with. You can set the combination.
Beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, beep. Yeah, maybe I should put my phone in there and then
you just, you'd have like, to watch TBS.
Well, yeah, yeah. Watch Sex and the City, which is what you do in hotel rooms. But the like cognacs and wine. I mean, these things have for many, many years been part of the luxury, asset world. They've been, you know, we all know about expensive bottles of wine that mm-hmm. sell at auction, old bottles of cognac that are in some cases, you know, 100, 200 years old even, on somebody's bar or at somebody's dinner table would be a way of not just communicating that you're rich, but that you have exquisite taste, that you're a member of this, you know, illustrious class.
It makes your party an event, right? We're going to taste the 1908.
That's right.
I'm just making this up for movies. Or you could like lure a friend downstairs and then brick them into the wall behind your wine cellar.
Demontiano.
That's another thing you could try.
That's a wonderful thing.
When you're sending out your invitation.
You'll have a pit and a pendulum and an Amontillado.
You can't do it more than once. Like, I feel like the cops would figure out pretty quick. These people keep disappearing after they check out this guy's wine cellar.
That wine cellar, if I recall correctly, is pretty big. I mean, big enough that you could wall off a whole section of it just to like murder a dude.
What if you walk into somebody's wine cellar and there's all these little cutouts on the wall, like little phone booth style things sticking out?
Hey, go in here. It's right in there.
Ladies, that's a red flag.
It seems a little bit Game of Thronesy.
Yeah.
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 But that's where you're going to end up being when the White Walkers come.
Just put them all adjacent to each other so that all the little, people buried alive, the skeletons buried alive, are kind of all on the same wall.
Right.
So, you know, the room will start to shrink slowly, but, not noticeably.
Yeah. I mean, it's not
to
like
the eyes of the Venetian police force.
It's not a John Wayne Gacy situation where you end up not being able to walk on the floor.
No.
We're going to get a lot of letters, I think, because this is a realm where people have, in any connoisseur situation, part of the appeal is there's a lot of information. Mm. There's a lot to digest.
Expertise.
Both literally and figuratively. Yeah, expertise. There's a lot of, there's a whole, it's things you can write magazine articles about. It's a world where the barrier to entry is actually pretty low because you can go to Trader Joe's and buy a bottle of $5 Chuck, or you can get a $20 bottle of wine, or you can get a $40 bottle of wine. And if you are interested in it but can't afford a $4,000 bottle of wine, you can still take an interest in wine. Mm-hmm. You can take an interest.
There's something for every wallet and budget.
That's right. And if you want to have, if you want to be in the nice watch game, you don't have to get a Patek Philippe. There are lots of entry level nice watches, right? And so booze and specifically whiskey has become a big, big place in the luxury comestible market, but also in the investment market and the collector market. And it's happened as actually surprisingly recently.
Really?
Yeah. Like whiskey is,
because you think of it as a very old school thing, somebody enjoying a very expensive bottle of wine. But not for investment purposes.
Well, so wine, again, being a slightly different thing, like a wine cellar, a well-appointed cellar full of great vintages, has been a sign of wealth and class for a long time. And you usually, you know, and every, I don't want to, like, embarrass myself by trying to describe the wine market, because boy, that feels like a, that feels like 10 episodes of Omnibus.
And we'd actually have to do some research, which we just
But you know, my uncle Cal had a vineyard in Oregon.
Huh.
And he had a vintage of wine called Knutson Arath. And so all through my childhood, my uncle's winery and their wine, Knutson Arath, was something that was on the dinner table in our family everywhere. And we would go down to Oregon to the winery, and he would have tastings, and he had in his home a giant cellar that had wines from around the world. And he'd spent a lot of time in France learning the trade. His, he then got into champagne, and his brand of champagne was Argyle from Oregon, which became a very successful sparkling wine.
It's not from the Champagne region of
it's
Oregon.
It's not a Champagne, but it's from whatever the hills there in Dundee.
Yeah.
And Argyle you can still buy, but now my cousins have gone and taken back the old vineyard. And
was it abandoned and overgrown?
No, or? No, no. What happened was they stopped making Knutson Arath and they started selling the grapes. So they'd owned it the whole time, but they'd been selling the grapes to other. And so they've taken it all back. They took the house back from Arath himself just recently. And they've started Knutson Vineyards, which is their new brand.
I didn't know you had such a Scandinavian wing of your family.
Knutson's. Good and the Knutson, and so if you're listening and can find Knutson wine, by all means, those are my first cousins. I don't drink, so I don't benefit from it. And obviously, they're my first cousins, and so they don't give me any money.
And you have no idea if it's good or not.
I don't. Although I know it's good.
It's,
I mean,
well regarded.
Yeah, and these are old grapes now. Uncle Cal started that.
Is that good if they're old grapes? 60s? I usually call those raisins.
No, they cut them down and plant new ones. But I mean, it's a well established vineyard, I guess. So I grew up around wine, and I remember going into my uncle's wine cellar and marveling at the old dusty bottles and these kind of exotic looking French, you know, Chateau. Mouton Rothschild and all this stuff, where it evoked all the kind of feelings of like old Europe and unknowable distinctions in taste and color, and all the people sitting at the table swishing their wine around in the glasses,
almost aristocracy.
Yeah, it just felt like it felt like to me as a kid, oh, this is what adulthood looks like. Yeah. This is what sophisticated people do. You know, one day I'll graduate into this.
When I was a kid, I thought A1 was very fancy because the label kind of looked like a wine label.
Yeah, exactly. Put a little A1 steak sauce on there.
No, you don't actually put
some Heinz 57.
We were at dinner the other night with some friends who knew the sommelier at this place. And so he was bringing over wine and we were just kind of politely nodding or whatever. And he brought over one that had kind of a... The label kind of looked like not like an NFT, but it looked kind of like fun Etsy art.
Yeah.
It was like it had been like kind of potato stamp art. And I was like, wait, is this the thing now? Do wine labels not look like A1 sauce? And he was like, no, I think they kind of do. Like, this one's cool, but... So this is the new thing I'm going to get into, is actually wine labels that like look cool.
I was at a grocery store the other day and I saw a whole collection of wine for sale there. That had Snoop Dogg's face on it. And it was not cheap wine. It was, you know, more than $20 a bottle. And it was like Snoop Dogg wine.
I went to this extremely cursed grocery store that we love near our house. And they had breakfast there with like Lil Yachty's face on it. Did you know you can now get Lil Yachty's Reese's Puffs?
No.
Like, it's actually Lil Yachty's apostrophe S Reese's Puffs, as if he has been part of the creative process.
Right. It's
of producing these Reese's signature Puffs. Yeah, I don't know what I don't think he's changed the puffs in any way. Well, maybe he has. I don't want to claim that he hasn't.
I mean, I'm embarrassed to say I don't know who Lil Yachty is.
I've done a lot of things in my career, but this is the one I'm most proud of. I'm actually finally looking this up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he has a song called Reese's Puffs.
Oh,
Rap.
There you go.
So he's on the record puffs. As being a. But I don't know if they're. I don't think they're different in any way. Like, he's not, it's more like just seeing Mary Lou Retton on a Wheaties box. Like, none of the stories report that he's changed up the recipe.
But it didn't say Mary Lou Retton's Wheaties, but then she didn't do a Wheaties routine at the Olympics.
No. That follows your success. But I guess nowadays you just need to shout out the brand.
Yeah.
And they'll put you on the label. So yeah, I hope you can find in the wreckage of society some Lil Yachty's Reese's Puffs. They look delicious.
The crazy hipster label we'll see also plays into our story in a second. The origins of Scottish whiskey go back to the 15th century.
Really? What we call Scotch. Scotch is a type of whiskey and it has to come from Scotland.
It comes from Scotland and we think of the most Scottish whiskies, or at least over 50% of them, come from the north of Scotland, from an area on the coast there called Speyside. And that's where...
Speyside?
Yeah, S-P-E-Y-S-I-D-E. Now, I'm going to be saying a lot of Scottish names, Gaelic names. I'm not going to be pronouncing them correctly.
Heads up, everyone.
As a Welsh person, I feel like...
This is an act of patriotism for
that's
you
right.
to say it
that's
wrong.
That's right. And I would, and if I were saying Welsh names, I would also be mispronouncing them. But it was like every kind of spirit, they're easily moonshined. You know, people were making whiskey in the north of Scotland because it was a place that they were growing a lot of.
The legal reach was limited.
Yeah, and they were growing a lot of grains there. It was reputedly the water. In that part of Scotland has a very low mineral content, dissolved mineral content. So that
I'm always skeptical when people say something special just because of the water.
Yeah.
It just seems like they can't actually explain why their bagels why your bagels are not as good. So they just appeal to water.
So you don't believe that the artesian water of
the artesians
of the Olympia beer made it a special beer?
An artesian would have to come out of the woods and explain this to me for me to believe this. I have not seen the artesians.
What happened was up in Scotland, there was a lot of, there was a lot of bootlegging in there. And, you know, liquor has always been a thing that was taxed by governments, you know, through the centuries. And so
they got a captive audience.
Yeah. It was a thing where there were stills popping up right and left, and the crown was coming and cracking down. And this kind of all culminated in 1823. The crown passed an excise act in 1823 that basically allowed distillers to legally make whiskey up in Scotland and pay an excise tax, but not a criminal one. Enough that it could become a profitable enterprise. As you can imagine, the title of the oldest distillery in Scotland is also a thing both disputed and prized. The claim by a distillery called Little Mill kind of seems to have been the one that has taken that crown of thorns.
Actually the oldest.
Crown of thistles from the 1770s. But
older than America,
older than possibly. America. And originally these whiskeys were what's called, malt whiskeys, which were made in a single sort of pot still, your basic unsophisticated still that had to be cleaned out every time. You make a mash of barley, you soak it for a while, and then it starts to ferment, and then you stop the fermenting by boiling it over a peat fire, and you've seen a still in operation,
yeah.
And these were,
and is that good? Does that make it good if it's what's better, single malt, double malt?
Well, this is kind of key to our story. Those original single malts then were, you know, they were each very kind of. Each time you brewed a still, you would get a very sort of different flavor, depending on what went in and just what happened in the course of the distilling. And so as these whiskey distilleries tried to produce a
standardized
product that was consistent from bottle to bottle, they started blending different batches, and you would end up having a professional person who would taste the different mixes and blend a consistent tasting whiskey out of a selection of these single malts.
So is that why a connoisseur is more of a single malt guy? Because you can get more variety or...
Well, we'll get there.
More difficulty? Okay.
We'll get there. It was... And a lot of it has to do with, you know, once the booze is distilled, then it's put into a cask, and the cask itself imparts a lot of flavor to the...
Yes, the wood itself, right? That's what all the Kentucky bourbon people say.
Right. And a lot of the casks were originally used to, when they were new, they were used for sherry. And then you take an old sherry cask and use it for whiskey. So some of the flavor of the whiskey comes from what had been in the cask before. Cask making is a whole, it's the cooper's art. I mean, it's an ancient trade.
It's just a barrel.
Making the barrel.
Let's not give them too much credit.
But you know, you scorch the inside of the wood, and that scorching also imparts flavor to it. It's the oak barrels typically. And so, you know, this was a cottage industry, this Scottish whiskey. But in the 1850s, a couple of things happened. There was a new still was invented. What's called the continuous still, that didn't need to be cleaned out every time. You could make more booze. You could make it faster.
Are they using it still?
They are still using the still. And so there was a way now of producing kind of a cleaner, faster booze. And the rules changed, and you could now mix different kinds of liquor, different grains together into blended whiskeys and call it a Scottish whiskey. And so you got it became much more popular and fashionable in the English culture of the 1850s to have a blended whiskey. It was a higher proof. It was a more reliable tasting product. And a couple of things happened right around this time. There was the Gladstone Spirit Act of 1860 kind of legalized the manufacture of a blended spirit, where you were kind of creating a liquor out of bits and parts, and in some ways just kind of putting raw booze or raw, you know, like just grain alcohol into these other kind of...
Is this kind of a lower grade product then, or not necessarily?
We think of it that way now, but at the time, no, it was a higher grade. Mm. It was an industrial product. Scotland was very fashionable in the Victorian era because Queen Victoria had such a Scottish fascination and connections and Balmoral.
And that guy she was into.
That guy, that one dude. So Scotland was like all the rage. Everybody was wearing tartans Coincidentally, there was at the time, the fancy liquor, if you were a fancy lad, was brandy, but there was a devastating agricultural plague over in Europe that...
Yeah, this would have been imported brandy probably.
Yeah.
This is largely French cognac.
Ruined all the brandy. Yeah. And so there was this homegrown alternative, which was blended Scotch whiskey. And that continued... that continued to be the mainstream whiskey from Scotland for then all of the 19th and really most of the 20th century.
Interesting. So it's in our lifetimes that
fashion
changed.
Just before I was born, the distillers at Glenfiddich, one of the main sort of Speyside Scotch makers.
Which all have Glen in the name for some reason.
A lot of them do, because they come down from the Glens.
The Glen, they're growing wheat in the Glen? They're malting wheat in the Glen?
That's what's happening.
That's not where I would grow wheat, but okay.
Where would you grow wheat?
In a wheat field.
On the Fen.
Yeah. I'd be in the Glens, in the Fens, up in the Tors or the Coombs.
Well, Glenfiddich, they had the foresight to, in 1963, someone at Glenfiddich said, because here's what was happening. They were, throughout this whole period, they were making single malt scotches. They continued to use this pot distilled whiskey as a component of these blended whiskeys. So they were making single malt scotches, barreling them, and then letting the barrels sit in a warehouse.
And then it's an ingredient.
And it's an ingredient. And it's an ingredient that has a lot of flavor, but it's an unpredictable kind of art form. And so these distilleries were full of, in some cases, you know, decades old single malt scotches that were being that were often sold to other distilleries. You know, it was just like having a kind of molasses or something. Sure. And it was Glenfiddich in 1963 that first reintroduced the idea of a single malt scotch
that we're actually going to bottle
in a bottle. And even that was, it's still called a single malt if you are bottling a blend of single malt whiskeys from the same distillery.
Oh, really?
So it's not necessarily...
A blended whiskey is going to have different distilleries mixed in.
Blended whiskey is going to have booze from different places, different kinds. It's going to have different grains used. But if you take two barrels of single malt from different years even, you can combine them and it's still considered a single malt whiskey.
Asterisk.
Ken, there's also a term for if you combine two barrels into a single malt.
Of the same distillery.
Of the same distillery. Those are called double wood because it's two different barrels, and you can have triple wood. Triple wood, Ken.
I have never had triple wood.
No.
Maybe if I tasted one of these.
Maybe if you tasted one of these.
So that means it's coming from three different casks.
Three different casks. But in the early 1980s, this was still a very, a small world of connoisseurs, and it wasn't like a super big money thing. It was just, you know, there's always going to be some weirdos that are into some weird exclusive thing. But in 1986. At the McLallan Distillery in Scotland, and McLallan was a well-known supplier of barrels of single malt, but they weren't themselves. The McLallan was not a prized or well-known brand. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was one of dozens of people dozens of small family-run companies that were making this kind of stuff. Barrels of whiskey that then they sold on to other distillers.
It's a manufacturer. They're not. Right. There's not any particular prestige in their brand.
But a small group, a couple of the sons or a couple of the scions of the family, and a few kind of like marketers in 1986 were walking through, you know, new business partners kind of walking through the warehouse, and they realized, oh, we've got some casks here that have been sitting around for a long time. And a guy by the name of Willie Phillips was working with the Shayach family. And he and his pals kind of said, what would happen if we just just took this booze that's in this cask and just put it in bottles. You know, single malt was enough of a thing that this would have been a, it wasn't like a lightning strike, but it was kind of a,
yeah, it wouldn't be the first thing you'd think to do with an old barrel.
Yeah, it was a way of it was just kind of a marketing taking the temperature of the mid 80s and realizing, "Oh, you know what? I bet you we could sell this
to yuppies."
Thinking
outside the cask.
And they found some 25-year-old barrels.
Is that a good age? Is the older the better when it comes to single malt?
No, and it's not true of any of these.
Right. Eventually, stuff will turn into something not so great.
Sometimes it's an organic process, right? Mm. So sometimes an old bottle of wine, you open it and it's terrible. It's got
vinegary.
It's gone south, and then sometimes it's great, and the same is true with casks of whiskey. And it was during this walk around that they discovered some barrels. They discovered a barrel,
a single barrel
of booze that was 60 years old. And when I say booze, it's because whatever, I don't care about this stuff.
So if I found a 60-year-old barrel of booze, I would just immediately brick up Willie Phillips into the wall.
That's right.
And then I would just keep it all for myself.
And he'd be
in
there.
Is this revealing too much about me?
The McLaughlin
Montresor, let me out.
And so they were like, can this still be good? It's like doubtful. And they popped it open and they tasted it. And to their surprise and delight, it was still drinkable.
They weren't like, holy cow, this is great. They were just like, we could sell this.
Yeah, it was delicious. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody felt like it was the greatest whiskey they'd ever tasted. But okay. It was good. It was still very good. And it was.
I do this in my fridge all the time.
Yeah,
I'm like, well, who bought the sour cream and when? Let's see.
You saw me.
Yay!
You saw me do it a couple hours ago when I smelled the
half and half.
The half and half. I was like, no, I don't think this one's still good.
Yeah, I feel like I have a Willie Phillips experience like this every day. I'm a real connoisseur.
Well, what they decided they were going to do is bottle this this 60-year-old single malt whiskey. That was in cask number 263.
Mm.
And out of the cask, they managed to get 40 bottles of this malt. And they thought it was hilarious. They thought it was great. One of the people involved knew the pop artist Peter Blake, who famously...
I thought you were going to mention some Scottish Laird, but no.
No.
Peter Blake.
Peter Blake, who famously did the Sgt. Pepper album cover.
Yeah.
And they said, this is a good idea. Why don't we have Peter Blake design the label for 12 of these bottles? And so Peter Blake designed a cool hipster whiskey label.
Not 12 designs for one each.
No.
But 12 of them had the special Peter Blake.
Had the Peter Blake design. And what he did was he took some pop culture references from 1926, which is when the cask was originally bottled, including...
And the last time pop culture was good.
Yeah. Valentino is on his label. Benito Mussolini.
Yeah, exactly.
On there.
All these icons.
Weirdly, the golfer Bobby Jones appears on the label.
Yeah, golfers were big celebrities. And isn't he Scottish? Am I wrong?
He's Scottish.
So there you go.
And so...
This would be a very funny version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band if one of the Beatles were told, and you need to pick your favorite celebs from the mid-20s, and he's like...
or if it had only been golfers.
Big Bill Tilden and Robert Benchley, I guess.
Well, so Blake does 12 bottles, and they sell them as a cool, groovy new concept. And
for how much?
Well, it's funny because the story, the mists of time have kind of confused the question of the first time these bottles were sold.
Hmm. They just sat on the gift shop for a while.
Yeah, like the guy that was really spearheading this was a guy by the name of Hugh Mitcalf. And Hugh was the one that was like, you know, this is like a, this is a dynamite like marketing scheme. McLaren is still selling almost all of their stuff to the marketplace.
To Glengarry and Glen Ross.
And they make these, that's right, Glen Grant. They make these bottles with Peter Blake on them, and no one involved in the story can quite recall exactly what happened to them at first. They were all sort of sold, but they weren't, you know,
there wasn't like a splashy auction or anything.
No, and there wasn't really even a market for single malt whiskeys in this way in 1986. It's
funny if they just turned up in stores like a winning lottery ticket and some guy just happened to buy one.
It kind of was like that, although there were only 12 bottles. And so
of the Peter Blake
ones. Of the Peter Blake ones.
So these are noticeably more collectible than the 28 non-Peter Blake ones. You said there were 40 bottles total.
Well, so the other ones, you know, they sold these 12, but the other ones they still kind of held in reserve. Oh, I see. And in 1993, their Italian distributor said, hey, you know, I could get an Italian artist to design some labels. And he got Italian artist Valerio Adami to design kind of a like a line drawing label, like not a collage, but like a almost a Miro drawing. And they did 12 Adami bottles. And then there were two bottles sold with blank labels with the idea that, like, hey, you can, you know, we're doing these art bottles. Yeah. You can do your own art bottle for, you know, for two of them. And then the remainder of the bottles were sold under a program that the McLaren developed called their Fine and Rare Collection.
I thought you were going to say they were sold to elementary schools.
They were
a community outreach program.
They were sold to local winos. And the novelty of it was just that these were at the time 65-year-old bottles of single malt whiskey. It was kind of an unprecedented thing. Now, it's not unprecedented in cognac, right? Just recently, a bottle of cognac that was 258 years old sold. And
it's a risk, right? You assume it's good because other bottles of that same vintage have held up.
Yeah, and this bottle of cognac just last year sold for $144,000. And
it's more than I would have spent.
Yeah, right. It's but it's kind of a you know, it's a famous, I mean, this is 1762, this cognac. Like,
how does it even, I always wonder how these have gone undrunk. Unless they're from like pirate shipwrecks or something.
Right. It's astonishing.
It was just found on a shelf somewhere.
Somebody has it. I mean, and probably it will remain undrunk. Probably 200 years from now, it will still be sitting on a shelf because somebody paid $144,000 for it.
Oh, so people buy it. Yeah, I guess that's true. If you buy it as an investment means or even just as a sign of prestige,
right,
you're not going to crack it open with your buddies.
Well, in 1991, and one of the reasons that Valerio Adami was invited to dress up those 12 bottles was in 1991, a bottle with the Peter Blake label sold for £6,375.
Suddenly there's a secondary market.
Yeah, in a Glasgow whiskey auction. And so the recognition that, like, wait a minute, this 60-year-old bottle of whiskey is actually, it's made cool by the limited edition of the label. But in 1996, an Adami bottle sold for £12,000. And this was sort of the beginning of the kind of global fascination with single malt whiskeys. So I quit drinking in 1994. And in 1994...
As a protest.
As a protest to this single malt whiskey
to this thing. Terrible new trend.
At the time, when I quit drinking in 1994, I had never heard of a single malt whiskey. And so I never tried one. I probably wouldn't have been able to afford one. But it never, that was a thing that came later. And I remember, you know, whenever somebody quits drinking, they're always going to be 5 or 6 times in their life when they're like, oh man, you know, it's my daughter's wedding.
My chance to.
Yeah. And one of the things I remember in the late 90s, as single malt whiskeys were what everybody was talking about, thinking, well, I'll never have one. I quit drinking too soon.
That's the main problem. I guess I would have assumed that people who drink enough to consider quitting, maybe this is unfair, but maybe they are they not the kind of connoisseurs who would be like, well, I would like to try a more expensive version of that. I mean, is that that's not why you're drinking if you're if you have a problem.
No, and that's exactly right.
But does it add even at a level of alcoholism, there is a level of, boy, this is good stuff.
Well, a lot of alcoholics justify their alcoholism by saying they're connoisseurs.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends. If you're a rich alcoholic, 100% you figure out a way to make it about how you really care about the wine and whiskey. When you're a poor alcoholic, it's kind of hard to say like, no, 10 High Whiskey, it's really my brand.
I just would have assumed, you know, if you need the hit, you'd actually.
And that's the thing. I mean, what happened to me, and this is, I think, really common, is that alcoholics are always looking for a reason. And so if it's like, oh, what I never did was try the fancy, it's just your brain.
It would be a terrible reason to fall off the wagon.
Yeah.
Because of
just to try some dumb thing.
Some marketing guy and an Italian pop artist.
But the late 90s was the first time that I became aware as a pop culture consumer that this was something now that was magazine articles were being written about. Single malt whiskeys. But the thing is that these whiskeys, they all sold, and a few of these bottles got drunk at somebody's party.
Shouldn't they be?
Well, before...
I'm in favor of that. Oh, I see. They just got drunk by people who didn't know what they had.
Yeah, well, they knew what they had, but they were fancy pantses who could afford to drink a $5,000 bottle of whiskey.
You have yet to make the case that the liquor is any better.
Do
critics agree that it's some special cask?
What's strange is that very few people have ever consumed it. The guys that were there, I mean, you know, it was submitted. So Alan and Peter Shyack, who were the scions of the McClellan family, Frank Newlands, Willie Phillips, Hugh Mitcalf were all there that day when they discovered this barrel and said, like, hey, what would happen? They submitted it to the McClellan's nosing panel, mm-hmm. who decided, yes, this is a sellable thing. But after that, the only people that have ever had it are the very, very few unknown rich weirdos who actually drank these bottles before they were worth what they ultimately came to be worth.
And nowadays there's no douchey son of an oligarch crashing into a railing in his his Bugatti. And
there are those, but the value of the bottles has become so much greater as a collectible, a thing to sit on the shelf,
yes,
and be evidence of your superiority than even to be so like gross, so vulgar as to drink it. Mm. One critic who had tasted it described it thusly. He said it was not the best scotch he'd ever had.
They should not put that on the label.
He named some scotch from 1997 that he said was way better. But he said it had notes of prunes and dates.
Yeah, so it's like Dr. Pepper.
Some clover, ginger, and cinnamon. And I was like, this smells like a potpourri candle to me so far.
Yeah,
but he said
it
also had subtle elements of orange marmalade or marmalade.
Why not?
Peat smoke, oak tannins, linseed oil, leather. I mean, at this point,
he's just naming stuff.
I'm stunned that his palate is so sophisticated. Ripe pears. Sweet caramel.
This is definitely a case where the more things you name, the better your palate looks, so you're incentivized.
Yeah, he also tasted apple, honey, and vanilla. So it's all there. I mean, what other flavors are there?
Pretty good. Some of those are things I would eat. I'm not going to go have some leather and linseed oil for lunch, but apples and vanilla, okay.
He didn't say soy sauce or wasabi, but almost every other flavor is in that list. But because of the limited number, the 40 bottles, and because of the connection to the kind of Peter Blake and the hip art, and because there was this precedence of a bottle selling in 1996 for £12,000, when the next bottles came on the market,
oh right, they still got a reserve.
It wasn't for a couple of decades. And apparently in 2011, the earthquake in Japan, apparently there was a pair, one Blake and one Adami, in someone's collection that fell off a shelf and broke.
Oh.
So that was the last anybody heard about these bottles until 2018.
I would go look it up if it, you know. I mean, I guess it's soaking into the carpet.
Well, and it's one of those things where if you're a collector, I'm sure you submit a claim to your insurance company, but it's pretty hard to value given that only a handful of these bottles have ever sold.
This is an aside, but I heard recently that, do you have any memory of when Wheel of Fortune used to give out prizes? You'd solve the puzzle and you'd have to pick out furniture items from a carousel of decor.
Yeah.
Until your money was gone.
Yeah.
So often people would end up buying the lowest cost item because they'd, you know, Chuck or Pat would make you keep buying until you did not have enough money, and then you would get a service merchandise gift certificate. And so people ended up with the lowest cost item in the showcase, which was often the ceramic Dalmatian. And after the Northridge quake, you know, that LA quake in the, when was that, late 90s? When was the Northridge quake?
Yeah.
Suddenly Wheel of Fortune started getting calls from past contestants whose ceramic Dalmatian had not survived the quake.
Uh-oh.
And they got dozens of calls. Hey, I need to get a new Dalmatian and I can't find who... And of course, nobody had made them in years and years and years.
Right.
And all the Dalmatians are now gone. Although I did once see one in a closet of the Wheel of Fortune soundstage.
Do you feel like they're worth a lot of money now?
I wonder if there's an aftermarket for...
Almost certainly.
There's no temptation to drink it.
Almost certainly there is.
Let me ask you this. Well, maybe this is not something I want to get into too deeply with a recovering alcoholic, but
yeah.
Is the experience of drinking... Like my experience with... with hard liquor like that is that it's like an overwhelming taste. You know, it's an overwhelming sensory experience, not akin to actually any kind of other thing you would put in your mouth.
Right.
So are you able to extract pleasurable, is it smooth enough that you can extract pleasurable notes of apple and vanilla or whatever? Yeah. Or is it?
I mean, you also don't drink coffee, but coffee has undergone the same transformation, right? In the 1980s, most of the people I knew were still drinking Folgers
Maxwell
coffee.
Maxwell House, yeah.
And it was only in the 90s that we saw in the United States this explosion of interest in coffee as a connoisseur item. And, you know...
But even though it's fire water in your mouth...
It has... there's a lot of difference in different boozes. There's a lot of difference in the buzz that you get from gin... or bourbon or wine. You know, your whole experience, the whole experience of the journey of drinking, the experience of drinking four glasses of wine and four shots of whiskey are like universes apart.
There's also the cultural difference, right? Where particularly now single malt whiskey has a real kind of masculinity.
Absolutely.
To it. You know, it's a punchline that, you know, Nick Offerman's character is going to love that stuff because that's what a man drinks. Is there anything about the quality of the drink itself that lends itself to that?
Well, it's hard to drink. I mean, if you gave a sip of whiskey to a child, the child would glare at you with hateful eyes.
I am the child in this story. To me, this is at odds with the nosing guy saying, oh, delightful.
Right.
Notes of maple or whatever.
And the same is true with coffee or wasabi. I mean, all of these things are adult tastes. I don't think there's anyone in the world, the first time they have wasabi, who thinks, this is spectacular. I can't wait to put this on all of my raw fish. Right? I mean, if you went to my daughter and said, you know, there's one thing that makes raw fish better, and that is this tiny ground up root that will
shoots daggers up your nose.
Yeah. That makes your nose uncontrollably run. So this is, it's part of the experience, I think, of as you've lived life longer and more fully, you're really trying to torture your body.
Right. I've done all the normal stuff to my body and I'm still alive.
Yeah.
It's the human death urge means stronger hot sauce, please.
Yeah, I'd like to do yoga in a 110-degree room. I'd like to go to a spa where they hit me with reeds. Like, it's
nobody's massaging me hard enough.
All of these things are part of the, but I do believe absolutely, just like the people who work in perfumeries who can detect tiny little amounts of flavor.
That's
I mean, even Napoleon Dynamite can taste when there's bleach in the milk. Like it's absolutely an aspect, and whether or not that connoisseurship, at what point, as you say, is it worth 200 times more? At what point also does being able to divine these micro differences, is it really anything more than a sport of the senses?
Illusion?
Or even if it's actual, what its value is.
Right.
It's just very personal.
To the end consumer.
So fast forward to recent days. A bottle comes on, or I'm sorry, a pair of bottles, one of each, the Blake and the Adami, and clearly they're collected by wealthy people who kind of have large collections. A pair of them come for sale in 2018 at Sotheby's with an estimate of $200,000 or something for the two bottles, given how the market has exploded. In the mid 80s, there were something like 30 single malts available in the world.
Now
there are hundreds and hundreds of them, too many to count. New ones come on the market every year. So
they're running out of Locks and Glens name them after.
No more Glens.
They're making up fake Locks at this point.
These bottles end up selling for 1.2 million pounds.
Oof.
Two bottles of this whiskey. The following year, a single bottle of it, and I think it's a Blake bottle, sells for $1.9 million.
Yeah, once it becomes an investment item, the money comes in.
At one point, the artist Michael Dillon paints one bottle along the way somewhere, and that sells at auction for $1.2 million. The prices have become depressed slightly. Bottle sold just this year in 2021, but it only fetched $1.4 million.
Oh, time to jump in.
So this is when you want to get on it.
We're giving investment tips on the show now.
But this has become now a global luxury marketplace. The single malt Scotch whiskey, and a lot of this is being driven by consumers in Asia, and there are a lot of Japanese whiskeys that obviously aren't Scotch, but they are part of this. You make it Suntory times.
But is there some extra cachet of coolness that comes with their decades old Scottish heritage for this new Chinese money?
Because Cask 263 is kind of the originator, it's the rhyme animal, and it's also there's only 40 bottles, or there were only 40 bottles. It's unclear how many there are now.
There's none that are unsold, right? McClellan's not holding on to any?
McClellan doesn't have any. No, they all were gradually. I mean, they sold some of them as part of this fine and rare collection. I mean, obviously, I think they wish they'd kept a couple
just like
sitting around.
I wish I'd bought Bitcoin 10 years ago too. But
it's astonishing how much this has become. I mean, whiskey represents just the tourist money of people coming to Scotland to go on the whiskey trail.
Uh-huh.
Is like 70 million pounds a year in industry.
Wow.
They don't need
England.
No, they don't. They could be an independent country.
Go back to the EU and live on the whiskey money.
Whiskey exports are a $4 billion industry for Scotland. And now, like, I think the most expensive Japanese whiskey is a whiskey by Karuizawa. Karuizawa, I guess, is how it's pronounced. That's a $312,000 bottle of whiskey called the Dragon. But there are also now collectors who have been collecting whiskey long enough that they've amassed enormous collections. The former son of the owners of Pepsi of Denver.
The bottling plant?
The bottling plant for Pepsi-Cola in Denver died recently at the age of 67. His name was Robert Gooding, and he had 3,900 bottles of single malt scotch in his collection.
I wonder if it's the kind of thing, you know, with a lot of collections, just the idea that you have it and you can go peruse it is a big part of the pleasure.
Right.
And I wonder for a guy like this, if he's not even like, you know, selecting the right one for a party, like, does he know he's never going to drink any of these? Or like, is part of it just, would that ruin the fun of having it if he'd actually drank one?
No. Well, boy, I don't know. Can you drink at the point that you're drinking a $2 million bottle of scotch, every shot is worth tens of thousands of dollars. At what point is that just, it's like that hamburger with gold leaf. You know, at what point are you just...
Some people are going to love the gauchness of it.
Yeah.
Some people are going to be repelled by
it. You're just pissing on the poor, but that has its own appeal.
Right.
To give you some sense of the, by comparison, the most expensive bottle of wine ever sold was a bottle of Romani Conti. It was a bottle
From what year?
From 1995.
Oh, really?
And it was for $558,000. So one quarter of the price of the McLaughlin.
I would have assumed wine was the bigger and rarer market.
The older, the 1945 Chateau Mouton Rothschild, which is like a super cool, like end of World War II.
Sure, that's like bottle. The James Bond.
$300,000. In auction.
What's the reason for the difference? The smaller batches? Is it all just rarity?
It's just, I mean, I think there are bottles of wine there's a bottle of wine called the Screaming Eagle from 1992 that sold for $500,000. And it doesn't have.
Screaming Eagle sounds like malt liquor.
I know. It sounds like it should have Snoop Dogg on it. It doesn't even have as many bottles as the McLaughlin. No, it's just that it has become a thing. But to give you another sense, in the cigar market, so this is really cool. In 2012, some archaeologists found 800 Mayan cigars that were over 600 years old. Buried in pots under the ground.
The Mayans tobacco leaves into cigars, not too different from our modern ones.
If you look at these cigars, they are cigars.
Wow.
They look exactly like a cigar that you would buy in a box. And because they'd been buried in these ceramic pots underground, they were still good. And the cigars, and I don't know who these archaeologists were that found these cigars, but they were sold to a collector named Gary Liotta, for $500,000. These 800 cigars, and total. It seems like he probably got a good deal.
That does seem like a good deal. At some point, they're not making any more Mayan cigars. At some point, he's just going to be selling those for tens of thousands each.
Yeah, but there is a cigar called the Gurkha Royal Cortesian cigar, which is with each cigar is dipped in Remy Martin Black Pearl Louis XIII. They dip the cigar in the cognac, and it sells the cognac itself sells for $165,000 a bottle. So
this is like the little bit of caviar and the little bit of foie gras on your gold leaf burger.
Exactly. Then the tobacco is grown in the Himalayas. When they were growing the tobacco, they only water the tobacco with Fiji water.
Fiji?
Fiji water.
That's the best water? Is that what the artisans told them?
Apparently, that's what they are using in the Himalayas. They wrap the cigar in gold leaf. The band is embellished with 5 carats of diamonds, and when the cigar rollers roll the cigar, they're blindfolded so that their senses are heightened to roll the perfect cigar using only their sense of smell and their fingers. And that cigar, the Gurkha Royal Cortesian, sells for $1 million a piece.
Let me tell you a funny story along those lines. Flint, Michigan still doesn't have drinking water. And that concludes Cask 263, entry 191.PR2321, certificate number 13321, in the omnibus. I can't. In hindsight, I can't believe we got out of that with no, this is why we can't tax the rich.
Well, you got it there.
This is why we can't tax the rich, John. They'll stop dipping their cigars in Remy Martin. Look, our civilization is clearly doomed, as this entry should have told you. Digging through the rubble, you may find evidence of social media. We were at Omnibus Project. I'm at Ken Jennings. My co-host here is at John Roderick. Check out his archive and or Patreon. We could be emailed at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Contemporary listeners found each other at the Futurelings communities on Facebook and Reddit and Discord and whatnot. Do you think people are going to start sending us single malt scotch after they hear this?
Well, just be aware that we don't drink, so it would only be a collector thing, but I'm totally into collecting some weird thing.
I would start fires with it if somebody sent me super valuable.
Boom.
Oh, we got a package here from, you can send us physical artifacts. It doesn't have to be cigars that have been through a civet's butt or whatever.
I've had that. I've had the coffee through a civet's butt. So Jonathan Colton bought me a $15 cup of coffee one time back when you could still get civet butt coffee for $15.
Those were the days.
And let me tell you, it was incredible.
Oh, really? You could taste every every penny.
It wasn't the taste. It was the buzz. It was such a radical buzz. I was flying. Very into it.
This is from Chris Martin, presumably not of Coldplay fame. He sent Johnny, apparently he gave you a heads up that he was going to send you a pair of pants, and he did.
What? Whoa, hello.
Did you not hear that Chris was going to send you a pair of pants?
Well, I don't know how long ago Chris would have sent it.
It was a message on your Patreon.
Oh, I do remember these. These are U.S. Navy official uniform pants, because I have a U.S. Navy officer's tunic. And these are the pants that go with it. That's great. I hope that they fit.
In all fairness, he wanted to make sure I didn't get left out. So he included a season brochure for his theater company, Stockton Civic Theater.
Lucky you.
It is looking like a great season. So let me just run down what Stockton Civic Theater has for us in the year ahead. We're too late for Something Rotten, the Renaissance, the Shakespeare era musical with the Carrie Kirkpatrick score. By the time this airs, you can still catch the end of A Christmas Story at Stockton Civic Theater. Don't shoot your eye out. Then in the spring, game show The Comedy You Play. I don't know what I think about my field being bastardized by musical theater, but okay.
Mine certainly has.
Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth. That's kind of omnibusy if you know the play. Oh, and that's in April. And then in June and July, Gypsy. So let the Stockton Civic Theater entertain. I can't believe I'm giving him this promo after he sent me nothing and sent you a nice pair of dress white pants.
Would you wear a set of Navy officers' dress whites?
No, but I'm also not going to go to Thornton Wilder in Stockton, California. So it's the same. Thank you so much, Chris. Again, did I say the address? You can send stuff to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. The most important thing you could do to support the show would be to think to yourself, you know what? The guys are always mentioning their Patreon. All I would have to do is just go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and I could enjoy some of the perks that come with my membership.
Yeah.
It's as good as smoking a cigar dipped in cognac.
Better.
It's better. It's better than drinking coffee that's been through a civet. rectum.
Yeah, I guess.
It's better than just some random single malt scotch that happens to have a pop art label. It's better than any of those things, and it comes in all. It's a product for all budgets.
Yeah, if you have $1 million to spend on a single cigar, give Ken $500,000 and give me $500,000, and we'll give you two great shows a week plus an additional show every month.
If you had the means, is there some insanely expensive item you would buy? Like just the equivalent of a cigar dipped in brandy? Would you buy Amazing Spider-Man number one?
No. I mean, I obviously there are guitars that cost a lot of money, right, and some of them I would love to play, but I wouldn't want to own one. What a responsibility to own. I mean, some of that stuff,
it would just make you nervous.
Yeah, it feels like it would be nice if there were enough 59 Les Pauls that it wasn't a thing that no one that wasn't super rich could even touch. Like Mike McCready has one, but he got one when you could buy them for $100,000 instead of $750,000. but no, maybe if I had a bag of diamonds that I could wear around my neck, but I think that diamonds are fake rare.
You want tanzanite.
Yeah.
That's the diamond of tomorrow.
I do. I want tanzanite.
It's not too late.
I don't know. Is anything you would want?
I don't know. Maybe art, but it's the same thing. You just get worried if you have something too nice.
Yeah.
Like, hey, that's an actual Matisse sketch, but like, should it really be on in your suburban house?
Yeah. I mean, maybe.
Shouldn't it be where everybody can see it?
I don't know. There's a painting that used to hang. Well, I'll tell that story another time. There is one painting.
What a cliffhanger.
It'll come up.
Better keep listening. Maybe you listened out of order, distant future, and you already know what painting John is talking about. I don't.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.